We found that it describes particles, relativistic particles with mass m. One can construct creation and annihilation operators by Fourier transforming the field operator, and the momentum, it's momentum conjugate. And so the Fock space of these oscillators is the space of eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. So each particle is created by an operator that we choose to normalize in this way. So this creates a particle. With momentum P and energy E, which is square root of P squared plus M squared. Now the ground state energy was found to be infinite. So in principle, that could have been considered as a problem. But first of all, the ground state energy, unless we couple to gravity, ground state energy by itself doesn't have any particular meaning. We can measure energies from any reference level, and we can choose this infinite vacuum energy to measure all other energies relative to that. So then everything will be fine. Now there is a way to get rid of it once and forever. Namely, we could have started. So this method is a simple example of renormalization. So we could have started with the Lagrangian that is Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. And then we could have subtracted a constant from it. Okay? So which basically, so Lagrangian, so this Lagrangian is the Lagrangian density, which means that it is density of potential, the kinetic energy minus density of potential energy. So when we subtract the constant from the Lagrangian, this means that we are adding a constant energy density to our system. So the physical energy density will thus be epsilon zero, which was our starting point. And then we learned that the zero mode fluctuations, zero fluctuations of the field themselves produce vacuum energy, which diverges. We have to cut it off at some scale lambda. And so the physical energy density will be sum of the two. So we could have chosen epsilon zero to be minus this infinite quantity, and then the two will cancel, and as a result the physical vacuum energy density will be equal to zero, or in principle to any, we could have adjusted it to any value we want. So this is called renormalization. We add some constant to the Lagrangian, and then we make it dependent on the cutoff of the theory in such a way that the physical result is finite, or in this case is zero. So in interacting field theories, it turns out that one needs to renormalize also the mass that enters into Lagrangian, so not only the unphysical energy density, and in principle other parameters like coupling constants, etc., etc. So this is the simplest example of this procedure. Now, second remark that I'd like to make is so when we quantize any system, in particular Klein-Gordon field, we need to choose a time direction because we need a Hamiltonian and we need to do canonical analysis, which means that we need to pick a particular direction in space-time that we call time, but time, so this immediately breaks Lorentz invariance, or it doesn't. The Lorentz invariance after that is not manifest. So we better go back to the picture where time and space are treated on the same footing. So in quantum mechanics, we do that by going to the Heisenberg representation. Or we may hope that going to the Heisenberg representation, we will be able to see the Lorentz invariance again. Because in the Heisenberg picture, the states are stationary and operators depend on time. While in this usual Schrödinger picture, the states are stationary. No, the states depend on time and operators are time independent. The two are related by a unitary transformation. So an operator in the Heisenberg picture is given by, let me take my notes. So the Heisenberg operator is obtained by a unitary transformation with the evolution operator. And let us compute what the field operators will be in the Heisenberg picture. So this can be done in two steps. So first of all, we can see what are the creation and annihilation operators in the Heisenberg representation. Plus IHT. But now Hamiltonian has a very simple commutation relations with the creation and annihilation operators. So at the end, they are transformed by an oscillating exponential factor. So this is because, the states created by these operators are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Eigenstates of the Hamiltonian just oscillate in time with particular exponent, and so do the operators in the Heisenberg picture. Now we can re-express, so we had an expression of creation and annihilation operators in terms of fields. One can inverse these relations, and then do the unitary transformation. And so at the end, we get the following expression for the field operator. So now we can see that indeed something nice has happened, because these oscillating exponentials combine into the expressions that are just products of four vectors, because we can form a momentum four vector, right? And then what stands here is just the product p mu x mu. So this is E times t minus p dot x. But still, the integration here is three-dimensional, and we integrate over three-dimensional vectors. However, that can also be the integration can be put into a four-dimensional form by the following trick. So let me first introduce some notation. So there will be so this is this usual step function. And then the following formula is valid for any function of frequency . So how does it work? So the delta function here has two zeros. So we need to pick up, and the zeros are at P0 equals the physical energy, and another one at P0 equals minus the physical energy. And we only want to pick up the solution with the positive sign, so we also add the step function. And then, okay, so the argument of the delta function is nonlinear in P, so in the integration variable. So we need to divide by the derivative at zero, which is 1 over 2. So the derivative is 2P0. So this becomes 1 over 2P times this function of the energy. And then we can write the field operator as a four-dimensional integral If you compare this formula that supposedly equivalent to the formula that we have derived and apply this integration rule, because here we have the symbol of the function, then we see that one reproduces the other, essentially the role of this delta function is to put the four momentum on shell. So the field is only expanded over all on shell. Can you see this part of this blackboard? No. Maybe I should rotate it a little bit. Okay. Yes.
I have some trouble understanding the second line.
Second line, this one? Well, there is a little derivation. You mean going from here to here? Because this is a definition. There is a little derivation involved, so one to derive this equation, one needs to use the commutation relation between H and A. Is minus AP. And so using this commutation relation, one can derive this equation. Yes?
First, in that expression should be the absolute value of zero that appears in square root, right? It can take negative values.
Right, but because of the theta function, we pick up the positive root.
Another thing. What is the advantage of defining the A's and all of it in a way that we need to have that square root of 2 is 0? If we define just the field instead of being 1 over the square root of 2 ep, just being 1 over 2 ep, then in that expression we wouldn't need that.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
What is the advantage of defining things in this one?
This is sort of old fashioned conventions. You could have absorbed 2 pi into the definition of the creation and annihilation operators. And this would be perfectly natural thing to do, because then everything would be Lorentz invariant here, because the measure is Lorentz invariant, the delta function is Lorentz invariant, theta, well, it's Lorentz invariant for orthochronos transformations. The exponents here are invariant. And so the product of this square root times the creation and annihilation operators is Lorentz invariant. Right? So the conclusion is that these operators are Lorentz invariant. And this was the reason to normalize the states as we did. So this, we chose to create one particle states with this operator rather with A. And the reason is precisely that. So that Lorentz invariant oscillators are normalized. So this square root then would reappear on the right-hand side of the commutation relations. And this means that okay, so they're normalized in a little bit different way. Anyway, so this expansion is a proof that this thus normalized creation operators are Lorentz invariant and therefore should be used to create one particle states. Yes?
Sorry, just to get sort of a big picture, where exactly are we going with this? Like, we wrote everything in a Heisenberg presentation now, but what's the...
What's the big deal? Well, let me continue. You probably see. So, one point here is that in this representation, we can easily see that the field satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. The Heisenberg operator satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. So why? Because when we act, or so the only thing that depends on x here is these two exponential factors, and then when we act on the exponential, d becomes minus ip or plus ip. So this operator acts on them by multiplying them with p squared minus p squared plus m, and because of the delta function, this is zero. Okay, so you have an integral of delta function multiplying its argument, and that is zero. So therefore, the field, the quantum field, when we transfer it to the Heisenberg picture, becomes a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. Moreover, this is just the general solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. So in some sense, we started with the Klein-Gordon equation, then we did a lot of calculations, and we ended up with the same result. But now this phi is an operator, is not a classical field anymore. So anyway, this is a general solution. If you start, if you started with the Klein-Gordon equation, yes?
So the Klein-Gordon equation in this case are basically the combination of the two Heisenberg equations, right?
In which sense?
Well, I mean, we go back to the Heisenberg representation.
Oh, yes.
And therefore, all these operators satisfy the Heisenberg equations of motion.
In a sense.
And they, if you combine them into second-order differential equation for the operators, then that's the Klein-Gordon equation.
Yes, that's right. Yes, so that's true. Yes, this is the Heisenberg equation for the operators. Schrödinger. Time-dependent Schrödinger equation for the operators. But anyway, so we're looking at that formula, we can see that this is the most general solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. Because, okay, Klein-Gordon equation is a linear differential equation, which is solved by Fourier transform. And so in Fourier transform, it becomes the condition. So in Fourier space, the condition that the condition becomes algebraic, right? So we can sum over all possible combinations of exponentials of plane waves with the condition that their four momentum is on shell, so that p squared minus m squared is zero. But then we can, apart from that, we can sum over all possible combinations of plane waves with arbitrary amplitudes. Now, the upshot of this derivation is that in quantum field theory, the amplitudes are promoted to creation and annihilation operators. So the mnemonic rule to quantizing field and so I write a field because it applies to not only to Klein-Gordon field but to any free field. So we will use for other types of fields as well, is the following. So we first find the general solution of the wave of the field equation then we promote amplitudes of plane waves into creation and annihilation operators of particles. Now, how to choose which one will be creation operator and which one will be annihilation operator? Well, you see that they are distinguished by the sign of time component in the exponent. The annihilation operator corresponds to the negative frequency mode. So since energy here is positive because of this theta factor, the oscillation factor has minus e times t here and plus e times t here. So the annihilation operators are negative frequency mode, and creation operators are positive frequency modes. Yes?
Before you quantize it, underneath those rules, are there canonical implementation rules for?
Yes, so in principle, one should always start with the canonical analysis derived Hamiltonian from the Lagrangian, find the canonical variables, and then diagonalize the Hamiltonian. But it turns out that it always boils down to this procedure.
They are equivalent?
Yes, they are equivalent.
Okay.
This doesn't follow from any sort of basic principle. This is just an observation, a posteriori observation on this form. So this way of quantizing field preserves Lorentzian covariance at every step, because it's manifest in the equation, in the Klein-Gordon equation, it's manifest in this formula, and we just declare the amplitudes to be creation and annihilation operators. So this is the utility of the Heisenberg representation in field theory, and it's also convenient when we will switch on interactions. So I don't know if I answered your question. This was the reason why we studied this field theory in the Heisenberg representation. So any more questions on that? Yes?
The dimensions of phi?
The dimension of phi?
Yeah.
Not very. I guess one can figure it out, but one can figure it out. So in our normalization, if you remember, A commuted on 1, so they have their dimension less. So this factor has dimension 1/2 at square root of energy. theta is dimensionless, so it's 1 or 0. Delta function has the dimension of 1 over the dimension of its argument, so this has dimension somehow it now let's see. So, if you apply this integration formula, then we eliminate one integration over dp and divide by 2e. Somehow it doesn't work out. I cannot reproduce the correct answer. Let me skip it over. I'll figure it out after the lecture and tell you next time. Okay? Then if there are no more questions, we'll consider another big topic, namely Dirac equation and Fermions. Yes?
I'm not quite sure why we're using the Heisenberg picture here. Will the field, will the congruent field in the Schrödinger picture not satisfy the congruent equation?
Oh, it doesn't depend on time, so the question doesn't make any sense. And so the Klein-Gordon equation contains time derivatives. The Schrödinger field is. There is no time. Time sits in the states that depend on time, not operators.
Is the Schrödinger picture automatic for this kind of thing?
Well, in principle, you can say there are any picture you want, so the physics doesn't depend on that. It's just that the Heisenberg picture is more convenient to see to make the Lorentz invariance manifest. So Schrödinger picture is simpler when you want to visualize what states do you have and what is the Hilbert space, etc., etc. Heisenberg picture turns out to be more convenient for seeing the Lorentz symmetry. So, returning to your question, I think that A is not cannot be dimensionless. On the other hand, yes. So,
you have in your notes here A sub p vector.
Yes.
Which, like, is an annihilation operator for a free moment of p.
Yes.
And then you also have A sub just P four vector. So is that in creation annihilation for?
Well, because in any physical state, for the zeros, the energy is related to momentum. So there's no confusion because zeros component is just square root of P squared plus M squared. So. In Klein-Gordon equation can be justified in very direct way. So we know that for the dispersion relation for relativistic particle can be written like that. And then just formally replacing momentum by derivatives, we arrive at the Klein-Gordon equation. Right, so in a sense, it is a consequence of the dispersion relation for particle of mass m. This is similar to the way we can justify the Schrödinger equation in quantum mechanics. We just take the Hamiltonian written as a function of momentum and potential energy and replace momentum by derivatives, and thus we arrive at the Schrödinger equation. So this is a very general, okay, so this is this should apply to any sort of particles, right? Because that equation is a very general principle, so that any particle of mass m should satisfy, the momentum should satisfy this condition. On the other hand, if we literally quantize the Klein-Gordon equation, we get automatically get bosons. And on the other hand, we know that in nature there are particles that satisfy Fermi statistics, and the question is how to describe them using field theory and preserving relativistic invariants. So the idea is that we should look at the field equations that are not second order in derivatives, but rather are first order, so that they start with time derivative, then we add something else, and so this will be our field equation. But on the other hand, fermions also satisfy the dispersion relation of relativistic particles. So their fields should satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. So we come to a paradox, right? If we start with the Klein-Gordon equation, we get bosons. But for fermions, also the Klein-Gordon equation should be true. Now, the idea is that due to Dirac is that we impose a stronger equation. So this equation should put more constraints on the field than Klein-Gordon equation, but the Klein-Gordon equation should be a consequence. So any solution of this type of equation should be, again, a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, but not vice versa. And then the idea of Dirac was to start with this equation and somehow factorize the Klein-Gordon operator. So it resembles it looks like a difference of squares. And the difference of squares we normally can write as the difference times the sum. But now, of course, here stands the square of a 4 vector. So when we write a linear term, so I denote it by p slash, then what can this p slash be? So Dirac proposed to introduce a set of fiducial 4 vectors, let's call them gamma, and define p slash as contraction of p mu with gamma. So he also proposed, so these gammas cannot be numbers, because if this, they are numerical four vectors, they will look different in different reference frames, right? So they should really transform as vectors. And so they should be in some sort, they shouldn't be commutative. So they should be some non-commutative objects. Let us see what is the condition for what this equation imposes as a condition on gammas. So we can write that p hat minus m p slash minus m times p slash plus m is equal to, if you open the brackets, this will be p slash squared minus m squared. The cross term cancels. So p slash squared is p mu gamma mu p nu gamma nu minus m squared. So this is convenient to write it as product of two Rn2 tensors, the first term. So this first Rn2 tensor is symmetric because we can interchange p with p. And therefore, we can write it as 1 half p mu p nu gamma mu gamma nu plus gamma nu gamma mu minus m squared. On the other hand, we want this expression to be just p squared minus m squared. So this should be Lorentz square of the momentum four vector. So the condition on the gammas is that their anti-commutator should be numeric, and proportional to the Minkowski metric. So if that is satisfied, then okay, this is the anti-commutator. Two cancels that two, g mu nu makes it p squared when contracted with p mu p nu. So this should satisfy, this object should satisfy this algebra. Now this algebra actually was, by the time Dirac proposed his equation, it was known to mathematicians. Actually, I'm not sure it was known to Dirac, but it was known to mathematicians. But this sort of algebra was studied by Clifford, I think, in the... when? 19th, should be 19th century. Anyway, for this particular case, the solution to this anti-commutation relations is unique, and is given in terms of 4 by 4 matrices. Okay, unique in the sense that they can only be 4 by 4 matrices. So the statement is gamma nu are 4 by 4 let me give a physics proof of this equation, of this statement. So let's introduce some linear combinations of the gamma matrices. So they're of gamma symbols. So there are four of them, okay, with indices running from 0 to 3. And we can form linear combinations, which we'll call A and B. And so, in fact, one can show that A that Hermitian conjugation that also follows from this formula is precisely acts on A and B in such a way that these are Hermitianly conjugate pairs. So then one can show that from the anti-commutation relations, we can figure out the anti-commutation relations of A and B. And let me see. So better introduces a square root here, square root of 2. And then the anti-commute on 1. So all other anti-commutators are equal to 0. And here you can recognize the relations for fermion creation and annihilation operators. But now there are just two fermion levels. So in a sense, the physical analogy here is a two-level system. So we have two fermions that can occupy two levels. And it's clear that there, that so this is equivalent to a two-level fermion system. And so each level can be either occupied or empty. And in total, we have four states. Right? So there is empty, 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 occupied, occupied, empty, and occupied, occupied. So in total, we have four states. It is better to associate them with spins. So it's rather, I mean, this whole analogy is absolutely formal. Don't try to make any physical sense of it. But the upshot is that there are four states on which these operators act. And of course, we know how they act. So say B dagger flips the second. So B flips the second spin, A flips the first spin. Knowing how this operator sets, we can compute their matrix elements. Then we can re-express the original Dirac gammas in terms of this. So the matrix elements in this basis will be just matrices of size 4 by 4. So at the end, we will find a set of 4 by 4 matrices for gammas. So all of this is a constructive proof. So we can, in principle, start. In principle, we can compute what the Dirac matrices are. The direct computation is kind of long. Let me just give you the result. So here, the 4 by 4 matrices are written in terms of 2 by 2 blocks. So this is unit 2 by 2 matrix. And sigma I are just the usual Pauli matrices. So one can check that these matrices satisfy the correct anti-commutation relations of the Clifford algebra. And the representation is essentially unique, although we can always replace gamma by we can do a similarity transformation on gammas. So you can see that this similarity transformation doesn't change anti-commutation relations. And mathematically, it corresponds just to change of basis in this space of states. We could have used any other basis instead. The anti-commutation relations do not depend on that. Now, sometimes the fact that Dirac matrices are not quite unique is maybe confusing. For me, it was confusing for quite a long time. So indeed, this is not the unique solution. Different solutions are called different representations of Dirac matrices. So this particular representation has a name. It's called chiral representation. There are some other representations which have names. So there is Majorana representation, so-called standard representation. Yes?
The fact that gamma naught was Hermitian and gamma 1, 2, 3 are anti-Hermitian in writing AA dagger. Was that?
Yes.
How is that conclusion reached?
Yes, so let me talk about that. So since you asked, let's discuss hermeticity properties of the Dirac matrices. So, what do these equations mean? They mean, so since the right-hand set is diagonal in the indices mu and nu, this means that the Dirac matrices with different indices always anti-commute on zero. So you can interchange them. You need to change sign. It also means that the squares of the Dirac matrices are either equal to 1 or minus 1, depending on whether they are spatial or have spatial or temporal indices. So, for instance, gamma 0 squared is equal to 1/2 of gamma 0, gamma 0. So anti-commutator of a matrix with itself is this matrix squared plus this matrix squared, and we need to divide by 2. And this is equal to 2 times G 0, 0, which is equal to 1. So gamma 0 squares to 1. Now, if we square, say, gamma 1, then instead we'll get G 1 1, which is minus 1. So if you square a Hermitian matrix, now squaring a Hermitian matrix, you can only get 1, right? Because its eigenvalues are real. Squaring an anti-Hermitian matrix always gives you, if it gives you something diagonal, it should be better be with a minus sign. So from this we conclude that gamma zero must be a Hermitian matrix, and gamma one, or to this effect, gamma I with any I, should be anti-Hermitian. So this equation can be actually written as a 1 equation. We can say that gamma mu Hermitian conjugate is equal to gamma 0 gamma mu gamma 0. This is equivalent to this equation for the in the following way. So you see that, can you see this equation from the last row? So the way it works is that if we substitute mu equals 0 here, then we get gamma 0, gamma 0, gamma 0. Gamma 0 squares to 1, so this is gamma 0. If you take mu equals to I, then we can interchange gamma 0 and gamma I using the anti-commutation relations, that would produce a sine and gamma zero squared. So we get this equation. So this is the condition for hermeticity, written as a single equation. Sorry? Let's see. So yes, I guess you should minus here and plus here. Does that make more sense? But then, okay, so and then I think the anti-commute is in the right way, right? Because the anti-commutator is basically gamma 1 squared with the minus sign, which gives a plus, minus gamma 2 squared, which is again 1. And then the square root take care of the normalization. Okay, so what is the Dirac equation? Well, this should be a momentum space written like that, or we can write it like there's a plus sign here, and then we substitute minus I times the derivative for P and arrive at the Dirac equation. Yes.
How can you see from those two equations that one is emission and the other is anti-emission? Because the equation only says that one is unitary, gamma zero, and the gamma I is anti-unitary. Right?
Yes. Yeah, in principle, yes. So you're right. It doesn't follow from these equations that they have to be Hermitian and anti-Hermitian. But if you require that, they have particular hermeticity properties, then this is the only choice. So in this sense, it is only true requiring that gamma mu's are Hermitian or anti-Hermitian. Then this must be true. In fact, you see that this equation doesn't preserve hermeticity, right? So for instance, gamma zero is Hermitian, but if you do an arbitrary change of basis, which is not a unitary transformation, then it will not be Hermitian anymore, So if you require that hermeticity is preserved by the transformations, then the set of transformations is smaller, and we will see that only those transformations are sort of important for the Dirac equation. Anyway, so this is the Dirac equation. Any solution of the Dirac equation is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, because we can apply operator P minus M to the left-hand side, repeat this calculation, and we'll find that psi satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. But the converse is not true, so the Dirac equation is more strong than just the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, what is psi in this equation? Well, since gammas are 4 by 4 matrices, psi is a 4-component object. Which is called the Dirac spinner. With alpha running from 1 to 4. Now, okay, it has the same number of components as a vector, but this is totally a coincidence. Don't try to find any explanation to that fact. In fact, if you have studied spinners, I don't know, I was told that you had a course on group theory. Did you study spinners?
No, not here.
Not here, but elsewhere. Anyway, so usually spinners are two-dimensional objects. Now here we have 4 components, and actually there is an explanation to that, which we will discuss a little bit later. So the Dirac equation describes a field, quantization of which describes fermions, particles with the Fermi statistics. And these are relativistic fermions, but the first look at the Dirac equation leaves lots of doubts about it. Relativistic invariance, because you see, we must postulate that gamma mu's are components of a vector, so that they transform as a vector. On the other hand, they are just numerical matrices, so given here, which take some particular numerical values, right? So they don't change any at all from one frame to another, but nevertheless, we should declare that they are form a vector. So this looks as a contradiction. There should be some explanation to that. Well, the explanation is that we should also transform psi. Psi should transform under Lorentz transformations. And, how should it transform? Lorentz transformations are some linear transformations. And so the only thing that we can assume from the beginning is that Lorentz transformations act by rotating the spinner with some matrix. So if you transform x nu to lambda mu nu x nu, And we want that gamma transforms the same way, right? Then psi should transform with some matrix, let's call it L. And so you see that this cannot be the case. So this equation should be, should be understood with certain care, because gammas are given once and forever, they stay the same. But somehow the transformation of the spinner should result in this change in gammas, effectively. So let's see how does it work. So if you multiply psi by L, we can compensate this by a transformation of gamma of this form, right? We can say that if you change psi by L, then it's effectively, instead of gamma, we will have L gamma mu L, right? So we can multiply both sides of the equation by L L minus 1, which is 1, and then effectively what we will have is this. And so what we should require is that this expression is equal to lambda mu nu gamma nu. So in other words, the derivative transforms as it is prescribed by the transformations in space-time, right? So that produces lambda, some sort of lambda here. Now psi multiplies from the left by L, and then we multiply the whole equation by L to the minus 1 from the left. If L is non-degenerate, then we can do it, because on the right-hand side we have 0. So at the end in the equation, we will have some lambda here, and L to the minus 1 gamma lambda instead of gamma. Now, if this is equal to the same as is equal to the result of a Lorentz transformation on gamma, then we will be done, because then the product will transform as if this would have been just for vectors. So we should require that Lorentz transformations act on gamma by conjugation, and that the conjugation by this Lorentz transformation matrix of the Dirac matrices is equal to the Lorentz transformation acting on the indices, on the vector index of gamma. So how to construct L? Well, what we will do is we will construct this for infinitesimal transformations, but then since Lorentz transformations form a group, we can take we can exponentiate, and it's enough to check that the infinitesimal transformations work out. So for infinitesimal transformations, we know that lambda mu nu is equal to delta mu nu plus omega mu nu, where omega is anti-symmetric when we lower its indices. So L should be also close to 1. And then plus some small correction, some infinitesimal transformations of spinors. And since this transformations is associated with the Lorentz transformations, so they come together, it should be also linear in omega. So it should be equal to omega, same omega contracted with some sigma mu. So the sigma mu is the, if you wish, generator of Lorentz transformations. In the spinor representation. And then to expand, if we expand this to the linear order in omega, we see that the condition for Lorentz invariants boils down to the following commutation relations. Between sigma and gamma. Because, so if we expand the similarity transformation to the linear order, that will give just gamma minus the commutator. Okay, similarity transformations, they produce commutators in the infinitesimal form. And this is what we find on the right-hand side, just by substituting lambda in this form. And we should, so both sides will depend on omega, and we should equate the coefficient in front of omega mu. Okay, so the next task, which we'll take on the next lecture, will be to solve this equation. And to find what is omega nu lambda. So thank you. That's it for today.